Greetings and salutations. I think that's what they say in those sophisticated circles. To all the constant listeners out there, it is June. This is the Far Middle Podcast. I am Nick DeOlias, and this is not a drill. This is real life. This episode, 54, dedicated to who some consider to be a person and who some consider to be a thing, but everybody considered him to be great. I'm speaking of Randy White of Dallas Cowboys fame, or the Manster, as in half man, half monster. That was his nickname. And that nickname, the Manster, was given to him by his teammate Charlie Waters at the time. Now, Randy White was strong. He could bench press 450 pounds 10 times, which is about 10 more times than I'm able to. And he was fast, quick as a cat. And he took a non-repeatable at the time legacy that was set by a great before him, Bob Lilly. So if you look at Bob Lilly, he was the anchor of that Dallas Cowboys doomsday defense a few years before Randy White came to be. And nobody thought that the Cowboys would ever see anything quite like Bob Lilly after he retired. But then here comes Randy White. And not only did he sort of reestablish that legacy that Bob Lilly set, especially on the defensive line and being a defensive anchor, but he actually improved upon it as the anchor of the Dallas defense for years. Now, Randy White was drafted number two overall in 1975. He was the second player in the draft selected by the Cowboys, of course. Who was the first pick right in front of him overall in the 75 draft? Some of you may remember a quarterback that went to the Atlanta Falcons by the name of Steve Bartkowski. Now, Randy White was expected to be chosen first overall by the Baltimore Colts, but the Colts sent the first pick to Atlanta. And again, the Falcons picked the Cal quarterback, Steve Bartkowski. That allowed Randy White to slide to Dallas, which had the second pick. They picked up that second overall selection in the first round, courtesy of a trade of Craig Morton, the quarterback, to the New York Giants. And as Tex Schramm recalled it when it came to that draft, he says, "We looked at other players. We did like Peyton," and he was referencing Walter Peyton, who turned out to have a heck of a career. Peyton, the NFL's all-time leading rusher before his record was broken by Emmitt Smith, another Dallas Cowboy, once said that a head-on collision with Randy White was the hardest hit of his career. So Walter Peyton would know he'd taken a couple of hits over his time. So Sweetness, the dedication for episode 34, he ended up going fourth overall in the 75 draft, two after Randy White was selected. Another interesting thing is that the Cowboys, when you look at the lineage of how they were drafting through that time period, they had the first overall pick in the draft the year before, 1974, and they picked with that choice Ed Too Tall Jones. And then the year before that, in 1973, they picked Harvey Martin in the third round overall. So in 3 years, the Cowboys, in two first-round picks and a third-round pick, they basically established the anchors of the defensive line and the defense and, frankly, the team overall. Super Bowls followed, the dynasty followed. Not too bad when you look at those three. Defenses, they win championships, or at least they used to. Randy White and Harvey Martin, they were the two co-MVPs of Super Bowl XII. Tom Landry, when he summed up Randy White, how did he put it? He said, "His performances range anywhere from spectacular to spectacular." I thought that was pretty good. Greatest football player in the history of Delaware high school football. He was a College Football Hall of Famer. He went to Maryland. He was a Terrapin. And of course, he is an NFL Hall of Famer. Episode 54 goes to the Manster, Randy White. Now, let's not waste any time. Let's start connecting dots. The last episode, if you recall, we had our first lightning round where we covered a bunch of quick hits that have been backing up for a while in the queue. Today, on episode 54, let's do the opposite. Let's dive deep on a big issue. And that issue is the convergence of energy in Appalachia, in economics, in geopolitics, in quality of life. Now, these are big themes, and they're coming together into an epic confluence. We get these right, we're all going to win. We get them wrong, we're all going to suffer. And Randy White, being a foundational anchor of the Dallas defense, very similar to what energy is in our society today. Ed Too Tall Jones was another foundational component of that defense, just like Appalachia is a crucial hinge for America and the world in the past and in the future. Harvey Martin, right, he was the center of gravity of that great defense, just like the American worker is for geopolitical stability. So without that defensive line, as I said, the Cowboys, they don't succeed. They don't win the Super Bowls. No one remembers those teams. Well, without domestic energy like natural gas, coming from regions like Appalachia, driven by workers that we find in America, the U.S. and the Western world are going to languish, the developing world never develops, and despots are going to run wild. Let's make episode 54 the domestic energy, Appalachia, American worker episode. Celebrate all three, get all three right, and great things are surely going to happen. And these issues, they are effectively the catalyst for my writing Precipice, the left's campaign to destroy America. They're the issues that I'm passionate about, and it's because they have an outsized impact on the people and the things that I care the most about. And by the way, you can order your copy of Precipice on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble, on Indie Books if you like, and all net proceeds are going to be donated back to the CNX Foundation Mentorship Academy. So it goes to a great cause, and I think you'll enjoy the book overall. And today, it's the most interesting of times when you speak of these issues, whether it's the issues that I wrote about in Precipice or just the issues that we cover in this episode or the far middle in general. Confucius, of course, said, "May you live in interesting times." Boy, are we. So I felt the need to discuss this at length, or at least relative length, in the context of my company's recent earnings call for the first quarter of 2022. And I want to rehash some of that, but I want to start with a little bit of context, that context years ago, as well as some context days ago. So first, the more recent days ago context. As the Russian invasion of Ukraine was dragging on, a lot of pundits, a lot of capital market experts, they were caught in a little bit of a bind. You know, they had a long track record of misappropriating ESG philosophy, and they were misapplying it to basically shun or attack, discredit, vilify, whatever term you want to use, domestic energy such as natural gas and pipeline infrastructure. Then when energy policy became geopolitics, as it inevitably will do, because energy is just that important and foundational, so when it became geopolitics with Russia and the EU and China and supply chain and inflation, when all these things started to rear their heads, everyone saw this misappropriation of ESG philosophy for what it was, which is wrong. So these pundits and these market mavens, shifting gears is what happened. You saw that where they shifted gears a bit to try to course correct. You started to hear them or see them writing and publishing and broadcasting how Russia, Ukraine, that whole conflict proved them right about the way they were misappropriating ESG investing. And how they said it proved them right was that they were seeing that Russian assets and companies were tagged as non-worthy under ESG doctrines and thus ended up proving to be non-worthy when they took valuation hits with war and sanctions and all these planned divestments that we're talking about now when it comes to Russian products and Russian business interests. But what these voices were missing was the 90% of the other side of the reality. And that side is that when the ESG was misapplied to pursue ideological bents, it ended up starving needed investment in domestic energy, like again, in natural gas and pipeline infrastructure, right here in my home region of Appalachia. And adding insult to injury, investors who had to follow that misappropriation of ESG methodology, or if they were pulled into this poor approach to a poor way to do ESG investing, they ended up getting burned when the inevitable effects of these policies and views took hold. So commodity prices went up because energy scarcity was manufactured. It was created via policy. The profitability of these industries went up. Their values went up. The portfolios that ended up shunning them were the very ones, by the way, that helped create these issues and problems globally. They missed out on the upside. They didn't participate in the upside. Their returns suffered. Which got me thinking to the longer term, and the context is measured in years. So now for the longer context, because 2022 is turning out to be quite the proving ground that it's verifying certain realities and exposing certain flawed beliefs that have been held as true for years. First, let's talk about natural gas supply and how that might be able to grow to respond to an increase in energy demand needs, both here in the United States domestically, as well as in places like Europe. There's been a lot of talk, and I'm sure you've heard the talk, about things like liquefied natural gas or LNG and how U.S. natural gas can save the EU by replacing Russian natural gas and providing much-needed energy security during a time of crisis through LNG. So for those of you that aren't familiar with what liquefied natural gas or LNG is, it's a pretty effective and simple sort of process or set of technologies. You basically produce the natural gas in its gaseous form of methane here in, say, Appalachia or within the United States. You then put it in a pipeline, send it to a coastal area, might be in Maryland, it might be in the Gulf Coast region, where it then undergoes a state transformation, a process transformation, where it is transformed into a liquid, very condensed liquid form of that energy, of that CH4 or methane molecule. And then in liquid form, it is then put on a ship, an ocean-going vessel, and that ship sails across the Atlantic to the EU, where it reaches another port. At that port, there will be a regasification facility where it takes the liquefied natural gas off the ship, regasifies it into gaseous methane, or CH4, and then it goes into another pipeline in gaseous form and ends up in the end country or end market where it will be utilized for power generation or for manufacturing or for home heating. So that's the concept of liquefied natural gas. It's changing natural gas from a gaseous form into a liquid form, transporting it because it's a much denser way to store that energy, and then regasifying it once it reaches the shore where it's destined for. Simple, but very powerful as well. And it gives us the ability, of course, to export that widget of natural gas to not just the EU, but to all kinds of nations and regions across the planet that are clamoring for it, whether it's for geopolitical reasons like Russia, or whether it's just for general economic and quality of life reasons, like you would see in places like India or Japan or sub-Saharan Africa. Now, at the same time, we can't lose sight of the energy supply challenges that we still have to overcome domestically. Those are realities. And certainly the industry is doing what it can to increase supply because most companies are trying like crazy to grow production and invest more capital for the year, that is 2022. Every little bit of this is going to help, but there are also some harsh realities that are quite ironic, unfortunately. The domestic natural gas and domestic oil and domestic pipeline industries in this country, they can't ramp up production anything close to the levels that the United States and the EU is clamoring for anytime soon. And that's not because that the industries are unwilling to do so. We are industries of doers after all. I've said that many times. We can do it. And it's not because of corporate greed or profiteering, as some out there might allege often and regularly. No. Instead, it's simply and starkly because policy is consciously and methodically looking to strangle infrastructure investments in the pipes, in the processing facilities, in the power generation facilities, and yes, in that LNG, liquefied natural gas infrastructure. And all of these are going to need to have investments to meet the world's energy demand, including the EU's. They're everywhere, these policies that look to stifle that type of investment that one looks today. So you see them on the global level, global policies like the Paris Accord, like the UN IPCC climate roadmap. You see them in national policies, especially when you look at the weaponized regulatory regime in the administrative state. Again, a big topic of my book, Precipice, The Left's Campaign to Destroy America. You see it in regional policies. REGI is one of those regional policies here in the Pennsylvania area, the Mid-Atlantic, that's getting a lot of attention that is and can be quite damaging to investment in infrastructure for domestic energy. And you also see it in some of these dysfunctional regional transmission organizations that are looking to manipulate energy and electricity markets, and that leads to bad outcomes and consequences like the ones that we've seen in Texas and California over the past couple of years. And then you see them in state and local policies. Some examples of this are these de facto natural gas development, transmission or end use bans that you have in places like New York City or Boston, not very helpful. And unfortunately, these policies, they have been extremely effective, very effective in achieving exactly what they were designed to do, which is to create energy scarcity, to run up prices, and to not allow the most sensible supplies of natural gas to reach the obvious demand centers. So that's why you have these outcomes where Boston has to import LNG from thousands of miles afar, including, unfortunately, times at Russia. That's right. We've talked about this before. Boston at times imports LNG from Russia instead of, right, taking molecules of methane from Pennsylvania, which is a couple hundred miles away through a simple pipeline network. And that's why U.S. politicians, some of them at least, end up pleading with dictators in Venezuela and in OPEC to increase their output of energy. And most tragically, that's why the EU is energy dependent on Russia today. And by the way, another tragedy of all this is that if you stymie the development and the embracement of natural gas, not just nationally, but globally, CO2 emissions are going to be much higher than they need to be, because natural gas is the key way to help decarbonize or reduce CO2 atmospheric concentration levels, at least in the next 10, 20, 30 years. So for our domestic energy industries to solve problems and provide solutions, which is what we're designed to do, it unfortunately is going to take years. The domestic energy industry has been under attack and penned in for over a decade by these policies, and now I fear it's going to take nearly as long to correct that. And that's assuming, by the way, the policymakers are going to wake up to the reality. And that's a big assumption, as crazy as it sounds, considering times like these where common sense tells us that what domestic energy has never been more vital, and the policies that are designed to stymie it, you know, they've never been more harmful. Now, these policy concerns, they lead to my next observation or dot that I want to discuss, connect. And this was one that when I discussed this on our first quarter earnings call, you know, from a policy perspective, I got a little bit of pushback. And it was an interesting conversation and engagement with those that didn't see it, at least initially, the way that I saw it. And through that conversation, I think they gained a little bit of a better appreciation for what I was thinking or where I was heading. And that observation is that despite, you know, having clear validation of domestic energy being an attractive and a deserving investment option out there, I think that access to the capital markets for the domestic energy industry, it's going to continue to be more restricted. Now, why do I think that? Well, it could be a couple of things. It could be something like that ESG investing, which has a good initial sort of potential if done right, but gone awry. If ESG investing goes awry, that could be a cause to this or a reason to think that will occur. It could be something like the Federal Reserve, if they adopt climate stress tests on banks, which make it prohibitively expensive, or if they punish banks when lending to domestic energy. Or it could be something like the SEC with what they're considering with climate change disclosures, if those disclosures are not consistent and really or truly increasing the true transparency and accounting of what's going on with CO2 and CO2 footprint. So to manage this risk or this concern, the prudent course for something or someone in domestic energy is to maintain a debt level on the balance sheet and a maturity schedule of that debt in terms of when it comes due, and a liquidity level, you know, the capacity you've got in liquidity or purchasing power, you set those at levels where you don't ever need to access the debt markets. And having the optionality to do that because you're generating or earning enough, say, free cash flow to delever and be independent of the debt capital markets, that needs, I think, to become the norm for domestic energy until policymakers, at least in the capital markets, they allow themselves to be mugged by the facts. And that might be something that happens in the short term. Unfortunately, though, you can't bank on that or count on that. That could be something that takes years to still occur. And what I'm proposing here when it comes to domestic energy companies and basically living within your means when it comes to the debt side of your business, it isn't all that different than what you would expect to see for a family or a household or a small business. So this isn't, you know, rocket science versions of finance. This is pretty basic common sense stuff. But I think it's crucially important for domestic energy companies to start thinking about their businesses and their balance sheets in that manner, because if you don't, you could end up getting caught. Now, third observation that I laid out on that earnings call, I categorized it, and I'll do so here on this episode of The Far Middle, under the topic of sadness. And I got some pushback on this one because a few people that had listened to the earnings call transcript, they said, you shouldn't have categorized that as sadness. You should have, Nick, categorized that as being fired up. You should be fired up instead of sad. But you know, I chose the topic or the term to be sadness. And what I said was that I had the benefit of being around the domestic energy industry and the company that I work for years, for decades, frankly, 32 years, my entire adult working life. And during that time, I've seen things come and go because of just the inevitable sequencing of that extent of time. I've seen something like a free market driven and an innovative and an entrepreneurial movement, I've seen that disrupt the world with the shale revolution, completely change the world's geopolitics, quality of life, and map. I've witnessed the establishment of an energy powerhouse that is the United States today, and energy independence for the United States if we want it. That's a key if. I've experienced a vastly improved quality of life and a bit of a revival, a much needed revival, I'll add, of the middle class, and an improved environment, whether it's lower carbon intensity or air quality or water quality, for places like my lifelong home of Appalachia. And I've seen that improvement in quality of life and the revival of the middle class because Appalachia and other regions like it, they've retooled themselves to take advantage of the shale revolution, to basically feed off of the low-cost, reliable, affordable supply of natural gas. And of course, I work for a company that completely transformed itself over those 32 years. What was once exclusively coal to now best in breed in terms of natural gas and midstream production and operations. And of course, right, I had the chance, and I think you guys know this if you're anything familiar with domestic energy, I've had the chance to work with people who care and who excel and who achieve. And by the way, they're compensated at the very best levels to be found in any industry. And that's important because we do go to work for a reason in the end. Beyond the why, like there's a motivation because you're making a difference, and there's also a motivation because you're providing for your family, for your loved ones to pursue your other interests, etc. So compensation, I don't think it's something that should be shied away from or sort of demoted. It's something that should be front and center in all conversations when talking about career, companies, jobs, those types of things. So, you know, over those 32 years, I've now seen and standing here watching a domestic energy industry that's strong, that's vibrant, and that's secure. And when you look at its future path, the opportunities, the best term I can come up with, are mind-boggling. From developing exciting emerging technologies that'll take things to the next level and the next chapter, to what we would be able to deliver to investors in value, whether individual companies or whether it's as an industry. I think there's a great value proposition there for investors and for the capital markets. But again, instead of saying that's making me fired up, the emotion in 2022 that I chose was that of sadness. And the reason was because much of what ails the nation and the world today, it didn't have to be. What I mean by that is taking someone like Vladimir Putin, he did not have to be enabled. And taking a country like the Ukraine, it did not need to be destroyed. Americans didn't need to have their households robbed by that thief that's known as inflation. And when you look at energy security and grid reliability, whether it's in Texas or California, like I mentioned earlier, or whether you're looking at Europe, none of those instances needed to be compromised. Yet all of these things that I just listed off, they all happened. It's all real. And it continues to happen. It continues to run rampant. And I think it's going to get worse, potentially much worse, before it gets better. Why do I feel that way? Because the full potential of the American energy industry to unleash prosperity domestically and abroad, it's been deliberately handcuffed. Energy scarcity has been manufactured by policy design. I think we're going to see worse in terms of energy scarcity. These industries, if you think this through, they weren't allowed to become victims of their own success. And what I mean by becoming a victim of your own success is we weren't able to provide more supply of our widgets so that not only infrastructure and demand grew, but so that supply and demand would balance so the prices could moderate, so that dictators like a Putin or like the Chinese Communist Party, they don't hold the free world hostage. Now, the current state of our energy industry and our economy and our geopolitical standing, they are not healthy. That is just a fact, as sad as it is to say. And until the health of those improve, we're all going to pay the price. It's just going to be a question as to what extent. This didn't have to be. And really the question to me that I'm asking myself and others, and I ask you, constant listener, is how long shall we continue to tolerate it? Now, you know, to some of that feedback or some of that pushback I got, maybe I shouldn't be as sad as I am, because there is good news. There's no doubt about that. The good news is the Appalachian region. We've got the resources, the know-how, the work ethic, all those things, to be the catalyst or a fountainhead of the modern energy and manufacturing industries. There's no doubt about that. We can be a center for skilled labor job creation to help pave a path to middle-class access, especially for the region's underserved rural and urban communities. And the only thing preventing this from happening is a collective willingness to embrace data and facts over stuff like politics and ideology. That's all it's going to take. So we should embrace the assets and the workforce and the energy in the Appalachian region to be utilized first in this region and then far beyond. That's sort of the supply chain. Start using it here. Let that demand growth extend outward. It can make Western Pennsylvania and Ohio and Western Virginia or all of West Virginia the true energy capitals of the world by developing and utilizing homegrown resources that'll build a local energy ecosystem that's going to cultivate and sustain the middle class for the next generation. Wouldn't that be awesome? And these natural gas-based products, they are the most environmentally friendly, lower-cost sources of energy that you're going to find. They're going to be sourced locally in the Appalachian region instead of, right, from these faraway lands. They've got extensive supply chains. They measure thousands of miles, and they've got extensive carbon footprints to go with it. You know, this view, it should get you fired up because it's realistic, it's actionable, it's a true solution for the Appalachian region, and it completely runs counter to other efforts that are championed by establishment organizations or by those with those ideological goals or bents that we hear from all the time. So again, I don't know if it's sadness. I don't know if I should be fired up, maybe a little bit of both. I think I can see both of those, sadness with where we're at today for sure. Didn't have to be with the problems that the world's facing, but definitely fired up about the potential and what the future might hold if we just let things take their natural course. So yeah, you get the big stuff, right, on policy, right, particularly energy policy, and then you end up with a region and a nation and a planet. They then have the luxury of not having to sweat the small stuff because you have time to be able to figure out the small stuff as you go. And then the flip side, you get the biggies like energy wrong when it comes to policy. Nothing else matters in the end. Doesn't matter how good of a job you do on the small stuff. You're still going to end up losing, or you end up in a worse spot than when you started. So it's that time again to bring a bittersweet end to our weekly talk. I hope you liked it. I hope you enjoyed this recap of some of the themes. I'm going to spend a couple minutes next week on episode 55, sort of putting the Appalachian energy magnitude in perspective for you. People are shocked to realize how big of an impact Appalachian energy can have, just the sheer magnitude of it. I'll just spend a couple minutes on that for episode 55. But, you know, that big stuff, those big policy issues, that can bring us to a topic we can end with for this episode. I want to talk about this week in history, particularly the intersection of music history and tax policy. So tax policy is one of those big issues, that big stuff, similar to energy policy. And it impacts tax policy, a lot of things that you would never associate with it, but things that you love, things that you enjoy. So let me give you three examples of what I'm talking about before I sign off. First, let's talk the Rolling Stones and a classic album of theirs, Exile on Main Street. So if you know the Rolling Stones, I'm sure you're familiar with Exile on Main Street, an outstanding effort from that group. So the group, the Rolling Stones, they started the U.S. tour for that album this week back in 1972, started June in 72. And that album was originally panned by the critics, but it came to be an album that was one of the most loved of the catalog. So the critics sort of changed their mind over to, as time passed. And it was recorded at Keith Richards' house that was in the south of France, while a few of the band, including Keith Richards, were in the grips of some serious drug addictions. So it came from an interesting place and during an interesting time of struggle for a lot of members of that band. So most of these guys, they don't recall much of the process for making that album for the obvious reasons. But what they do recall is why they were there in the south of France to begin with. The Rolling Stones at that time were tax exiles, hence the name Exile on Main Street. And the reason they were tax exiles was that the UK in the early 70s had a 95% income tax on millionaires. That's why George Harrison of the Beatles wrote Taxman. And in the song Taxman, there's that line he's got where he says, there's one for you and 19 for me. He was referencing the 95% income tax rate in the UK. So tax policy matters, even for the Rolling Stones, when they were too stoned to notice much else. They figured that out, and that's why they're in the south of France, and that's why they named that album Exile on Main Street. Now, the second example of this goes a bit further down the road, not 72 when the Rolling Stones were opening their Exile on Main Street tour, but let's go to 1979 around this time of year. A guy by the name of Tom Petty, he files for bankruptcy. Now, why did he file for bankruptcy? Well, bad deals, coupled with some unethical partners on top of tax policy, brought his finances to ruin. And fortunately, he recovered, of course, and continued making great music. But again, tax policy matters. If you like Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, it helped play a role in him filing for bankruptcy midway through his career in the late 70s. My third example is during this week, this time in 1991, a guy by the name of Willie Nelson, he started to sell his album, and the album title was Who Will Buy My Memories, the IRS Tapes. So he started to sell Who Will Buy My Memories, the IRS Tapes, through phone orders. And this album was made of songs whose rights were seized by the feds to pay off Willie's $16 million tax debt. Big policy stuff matters. Tax policy, energy policy. It can make or break nations and the myriad of things downstream, some of which we love and all of which we should care about. Let's get energy policy and Appalachian natural gas opportunity. Let's get those things right. And then get tax policy right? So the doers keep more of their hard-fought and earned value. That'd be a good 1-2 punch. Till next week, in the words of TV news anchor legend Walter Cronkite, and that's the way it is, episode 54, June 2022. Good night, good day.